Because you're jumping back into the gap. All right, to coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game. Before we start the podcast, I wanted to share a brief message from a recent member of Basketball Immersion. They wrote, I want to express my thanks to you for opening my eyes to a different way of teaching the game that I love so dearly. I joined in part to support the podcast work you do, as I know you put in countless hours. But I could have never imagined the depth of the website, the passion of your membership community to collaborate, and the impact it has made on how I coach. It's been an incredible experience for me, and I thank you. It was an incredible email to receive. And as your season starts, I would love for you, too, to join our Basketball Immersion community, not just in support of this podcast, but also in support of your coaching. Go to basketballimmersion.com to sign up. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. So excited today to have Coach Kelvin Sampson with us from the University of Houston. Over 600 wins in his career, time spent in the NBA, three-time National Coach of the Year, and last year, the greatest season in school history, 33-4 in Sweet 16 appearance at Houston. Coach, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. It's an honor to be on with you guys.
Well, definitely so many directions we can go and to ask you basketball-related questions. And I want to start with something. And 11th, I believe, in KenPom adjusted defensive efficiency last year. But what stood out to me in watching your team is that you appear to disrupt defensively. Is that part of the philosophy to be disruptive defensively?
Yes. I think as a coach, you're constantly evolving. My defensive philosophy has changed a lot over the years in certain areas. But I think the three things we work on the most is our pickup point is probably a step above the top of the key, somewhere around the three-point area. And then once we're inside that area, then that's where our rules come in. I think one of the things we do most to disrupt the game a little bit is how we double the post and our rotations behind it. We're very systematic. It's a four-step process for us, you know, and you go one, two, three, four. One is lock down the passer, so he can't, on the post catch, you can't throw it back. The defender to post is in the three-quarter position. He gets to the inside shoulder to the baseline side and the outside shoulder takes away baseline. Then we have a guy coming with high hands, tremendous activity from the middle of the floor. Then behind it, we have a crack back and top of the eye. And then we know who's taking the first pass out, who's directing the trap guy when he comes out. You know, we spend a lot of time working on our post-double defense. But our pick-and-roll defense, our post-double defense, and our pickup point and how we pressure the ball and load to the ball, all those things are, you know, we just drill those things over and over and over and over. You know, for us, they're simple. But that's one of the things that makes it so effective.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking about some of these things more in depth. In particular, I believe you call it monster. Is that what you call the doubling the post?
Correct.
Yeah. And, well, let's start there. Because often when we talk about doubling the post, the question that comes up is, what determines the retreat? What determines when you leave the double? Because that seems to be the gray area and the difference for a lot of teams.
Yeah. Well, some teams like to stay with the trap. I think if you get him deep enough on the baseline, you can. Our guys certainly have that option. But for us, any movement away from the basket constitutes a recover. We do a good with recovering, but we're not recovering to a man. We're recovering to an area. So if he all of a sudden he gets it back and can come right back into a post position, you know, we can go. Last year, before the round of 16, our second game in the tournament was against Ohio State. And they had this 6'8", 6'9", 260-pound kid, Wesson. Excellent, excellent low post scorer. Really good player. But one of the ways that we were able to neutralize him and make other people beat us is with our monster. But we don't just monster guys that can really score. We monster any pass to the post. It's been interesting watching the game plans because you can tell the other teams have really started to prepare how to attack our monsters. Some teams make sure that the entry passer is the four man which takes away Monster from the middle of the floor. So they throw it in from the corner. Then we've had to adjust to that. But that's all the fun part of coaching, Chris, is watching other teams adjust to you, and then you try to adjust right back to gain an advantage for your team.
Well, I love that. And they know you're doubling. And you said you're going to double no matter what, who. And who is doubling? Is it a set player or is it a set position on the floor that's coming with the double?
Yeah, that's a great question. A guard is getting doubled. Five is, if a guard is being posted, the automatic monster man is the five man. And, you know, we work on when the five man leaves to go monster, there is no hesitation. There is, you know, leave and come back. No, once you go, you go, you're committed. And then right behind that, our guards are reacting to him to get to their spots. We try to load the floor as much as possible. We get a lot of deflections on skip passes. We take away every pass on the same side of the floor the ball's on. Then on the other side of the floor, you know, there's an advantage, but you've got to pass through a double team for that. So we spend an inordinate amount of time with that. I like to do station work and pick out things that is important to us defensively. But one of our staff members in station work is always working on five people moving on the fly of the ball in our monster defense.
That's great. And I guess one of the curiosities, and I love the philosophy of disruption, like you're going to do something that's going to disrupt the other team. But one of the offensive philosophies now is one of the highest value shots is the pass out of the post. And are you finding that a little bit more, that teams are just passing into the post to run actions out of the post? Or has that come into the college game as much as, say, we would see it in the NBA?
Well, I think the you know, to pass out of the post, first of all, you've got to have a good passer. And sometimes the best passer is your guards. When I was in the NBA, one of the toughest guys to guard in the post was Andre Miller when he was in the NBA, regardless of what team he was on. He just, Jason Kidd, Chauncey Billups, Andre Miller, Mike Dunleavy was in our league at Tulane the last couple of years. I thought he did a great job. He had a lot of bad luck with the injuries, but he had some really good guards, and they were real creative. Of course, Mike, with his NBA background, you know, knew how to take advantage of every position offensively. Actually, I thought Mike was a very good coach, but posting guards, I think, is something that we're looking at. You know, the last 2 years, I've had 6'6", 1 point and two guard. We've been pretty small there, but now we've got 3 or 4 6'5" guards, and a couple of them are excellent passers. So one of the things that we're actually working on is spacing and cutting out of a post-double with the guard, making sure he knows where his targets are.
Well, it's a great point about posting the guards, and that certainly makes sense from that perspective if you're trying to pass out. So glad you brought that up. And then maybe the last question with Monster is just on a ball side cut. So someone passes or enters to the post and there's some type of Laker cut, ball side cut. Are we going fully with the cutter? Are we passing it on to the eye, as you said? Is there someone absorbing it on the weak side?
Yeah, if the ball's passed in, that, you know, our terminology that would be lag. I have a permanent blue line painted in the middle of our lane. And so visually and verbally, I can say, you know, get to the blue line. Or when we're going with a cutter that throws the ball into a post, as he's cutting through, our terminology would be lag to the blue line. So, you know, we're never getting past the midline, which is the blue line, our floor. We use that kind of as our GPS.
That's great. That's great terminology and great understanding for people. And your defense in general, I've read it, one of your main points is stop the ball and stunt the pass. Is that the base for everything you do on defense?
Yeah. You know, one of my favorite drills, Chris, is we try to think outside the box a lot. I mean, we're constantly coming up for the different ways to guard things. But you know, I'll go onto the whiteboard on our practice court sometimes, and I'll attempt to draw a picket fence around the paint. And we said, you know, our general philosophy is we don't want the ball to get into the paint. So I put two guys in the corner, two guys in the slot, and then we defend them from in space. And no ball screens, it's just penetration. So the guy in the right slot passes to the left slot. Now he can't cut. He's got to stay. The only time you can move on offense is if somebody penetrates and kicks to you, then you can shoot it. But defensively, we're trying to get into gaps. Now, it's important to know who is the help for the guy in the corner. You know, we don't want a middle drive, so the guy closest to him is going to be in jumping a help position. And then if the guy in the corner gets beat middle, we want to stop the ball. Now, if he passes out to my man, the next man over now becomes a stunt guy. And then the next guy would stunt for him. So we're stopping the ball, moving our feet, full body help, stop the ball and penetration. And then when that guy kicks it out, now somebody's got to come and stop that stunt to pass. Now, we don't rotate, and that's why I like stunning. You can stun and get back to your own man, but somebody else can stunt and help you as well.
Yeah, and I've used the term, who's your closeout, what's your responsibility? And when I looked at some of your notes, it's where's the ball, where are you? And it's essentially the same thing, but it's easier said than done. But that's the main part of all this off-the-ball stuff, as you said, this stunting, is knowing your responsibility and help.
Yeah, well, we were outstanding defensively. Last couple of years, especially. Last year was, we were a great team, defensive team last year. But, you know, we had a huge advantage. The reason our defense is so good is I had two guys out front, Galen Robinson and Corey Davis, that could guard the bounce. Your best players couldn't get by them. When we played Michigan 2 years in the game to go to the Sweet 16, the reason why we had a lead with under 5 seconds to go in that game is because we could guard them off the bounce. You know, B-line's teams will always spread you. You know, they like to, I call it ghost on-ball screens. They just pop, they just ghost and pop. But our ability to defend the dribble has been the biggest reason why we've been good. The other stuff behind it is all schematic. But unless you have players that can get in a stance, move their feet, and keep their nose on the ball as it's being dribbled, it's going to be hard to have any kind of good defensive team. And that's why we talk about win the first dribble. You know, most players aren't multiple dribble players. They're going to try to beat you with the first dribble to the strong hand. So we work on winning the first dribble. We work on taking away the strong hand. And we make sure you know whether you are the helper. And we put a lot of responsibility on the helper. The one person that cannot get beat defensively is the helper.
So you are locking down their strong hand. That's part of the philosophy, part of the scout.
Yes.
What are some things you do to work on that? Do you play a lot of one-on-one, or do you do a lot of just scout emphasis? What are some things that happen? Because it's such a great point for teams to focus on.
You know, I think that the most difficult thing about that is which side of the floor they're on. You know, if they're on the left side of the floor, obviously their strong hand is to the middle. If they're on the right side of the floor, their strong hand is to the baseline. But when we do station work this time of year, we work on our pick and roll defense, our monsters, and then closing out to strong hands. And then when we play 2-on-2, and the guy behind him has to be in the help position. So it's an emphasis. I think you achieve what you emphasize. Unless you do that consistently every day in your drill work or preparation work, it's not something that they're going to remember.
Saying that side of the floor, do you find one side easier than the other in terms of both individual and team defense?
Yeah. Well, most teams like to post up on the left block so they can get middle with their left shoulder and right hand jump hook. That's probably the best post move. But I also think it's easier to monster the right block because they're throwing back across their body, the post guys. That's where we get most of our deflections, on the right block. But the left block is the toughest one because they can make an escape dribble and have and pass it with their right hand or influence it with their right hand.
Coming back to just that individual defense, and you talked about having two guys that were just exceptional doing that. It's obviously individual talent. It's individual desire to a certain extent. But is that teachable? Is that something that we can develop more of? And if so, how can we do that? Because isn't that the ideal, that we had five players that could all keep the ball in front, as you said, for the one dribble?
Yeah, sometimes you got to play with their minds because most guys have a low defensive self-esteem. And that's why they foul. As soon as you put the ball on the floor, their natural instinct is to come forward with their hands. And as soon as their hands reach, their butt comes up, their feet come together, now they're beat. So I tend to be just a simple guy, Chris. I just think teaching guys how to play in a stance, teach them what a stance is. You know, quit sending guys left or right. Just square up and keep your nose on the ball. Win the first dribble. I think just working at it, there's a lot of different ways you can do it. I just think consistency. It's like, how do you make a good shooter a great shooter? Well, I'm not sure you can, but you can make him better. How do you make a bad shooter a good shooter? I'm not sure you can, but you can make him better. So I don't think you can take a bad defender and make him a great defender, but you can get him better. Sometimes better just means passable, acceptable. You know, I had a kid last year that was not a great on-ball defender at all. He got to where he was just acceptable, which was a huge, huge improvement for him and really helped our team.
How about talking on defense? How can we get our team to embrace talking more? Because I got to think that's a mindset of your team, is that they do a great job talking.
Yeah, we've had a lot of people comment on that. But we talk about this a lot, but you can always hear a good team. You never hear bad teams. Bad teams don't talk. They don't communicate. It's not important to them. But I think the key to that is the head coach. I really do. He can't be inconsistent with the things he wants his teams to be really good at. He's got to be really consistent in his approach. It's got to be part of his DNA, because if it's not part of your DNA, they're not going to do it. You know, it's like monster in the post. That's as much a part of our defense as guarding the ball. But they know we're pretty good at it because we work at it. Same thing is with talking. You know, there's two things I think you should work to get better at every year. One is offensive rebounding. One is getting your team to talk more in transition and continue that through the possession.
Love it. And you mentioned earlier when we first started, one of the disruptions is side pick and roll, and you ice or down or whatever you call it, side pick and roll a lot, right? Is that part of your NBA philosophy coming back to college? Or yes. What is the philosophy there?
Yeah. I spent 3 years with Scott Skiles in Milwaukee, 3 years with Kevin McHale in Houston. But I just learned from everybody. Scott being my first opportunity was just an excellent coach, excellent tactician, a brilliant, brilliant game plan guy. I learned a lot from Scott. But you know, you don't know what you don't know, right, Chris? I mean, we've never seen it before. Why would we do it? So, you know, I didn't pay attention a lot to the NBA in terms of the tactical things, but there's so many great coaches in the NBA, and I enjoyed learning from all of them. I remember having Orlando Scouts, Orlando Magic Scout, when Stan Van Gundy was the coach there. And he had Richardson and Vince Carter, Redick, the guy from Yugoslavia. I can't remember his name. And Dwight Howell. Yeah, Turkoglu. That's it. Those guys were so well coached. Their spacing. They had this thumb-out offense that they run. And I certainly stole a lot of ideas from him. But the way we down our side pick and rolls, our call is blue, is a little bit different than the NBA. It was when I was in Milwaukee, we had Andrew Bogut. And you know, Bogut was really good at his coverage calls. He always said them early, on time, and loud. He was a clear communicator. But, you know, because of his size, he wasn't able to get up to what I call the line of scrimmage, up parallel with the your defender's feet. Your teammates' feet. So he was always a little bit back, which means you're vulnerable to cross-grain dribble, which San Antonio was so good at with Ginobili and Parker in their heyday. They could space you, and they could play step-up screen basketball on both sides of the floor, and that's tough to guard. But the way that we do our ices or downs or blues is we get our big all the way up to the line of scrimmage and give him ball. Most people think we're trapping, but we're really not trapping. Now, on the other side of the floor, we bring everybody on this side of the blue line. We bring them all the way to the lane line. And so we're really, really heavily loaded to the ball. I've actually got almost five defenders from the left free throw lane to the sideline. That's how loaded we are. Now, most teams try to run pick and rolls left to right so they can get their right hand to the middle of the floor. So if you're down in that side, you've got the ball handler on his left hand. So our big philosophy is don't let him get to his right hand, keep him on his left hand. The defender jumps up to down it. He continues back pressure with great activity on the ball. The big man's up to the line of scrimmage. We're loading to the ball. We're forcing him to have to make a good pass just to get it out of there. So But I found that teams don't run side pick and rolls on the left as much. But then there's a different way to defend, like somebody catch, like a post guy comes down and he catches it out front and swings it to the wing. Yeah, swings it to the wing and chases into a ball screen. Now, we don't down chases. We slide those. You know, the big man opens up and the guard can get under. So we slide chase screens, but we'll blues all screens on the same side of the floor.
Well, it's great. And I was curious if some teams made an adjustment and started running ball screen on the other side of the floor. And if so, are you forcing the middle or are you still going to down them on that side? Because still you want them to go to their weekend. Okay, you're still going to down them.
Yeah, still down them. I think the key player for us is the guy who jumps up to down him. He has to continue on with that ball pressure. And, of course, our big job is to stop the ball.
What's the recovery cue for the big then?
When the guard releases him, when he says get back, that means that he's in a position to contain him.
So it's a communication cue.
Okay. Yeah, between those two guards. A lot of times they'll tell us what to do because a lot of guards see the big guy jumping up to stop the ball. A lot of times they just pick it up and pass it real quick. That's what most teams try to do.
And does the mid, the most important guy, change on a down if the screener rolls versus the screener flares for you in terms of who tags the ball screen?
Yeah, if it's a roll, it's the mid. And we define the mid by who's guarding the guy furthest away from the ball. And so I'm just going through all this terminology that may not make sense, but on blues, which are downs, it creates a black. A black means everybody's loading to the ball. So the mig would come almost all the way over to the lane line to just show himself and almost dare you to throw that ball to that corner. That's the one pass we're going to give up. When you downside ball screens, or if you monster the low post, you've made the decision to take something away. Well, if you take something away, you're going to give something up. So what is it you're willing to give up? And that's really our philosophy on just about everything we do defensively. But we have to make sure our kids understand this is what we're giving up. On side ball screens, we're going to allow them to throw the ball to the opposite corner. You're going to have that pass. But that's the only pass that we're going to allow.
Yeah, it's a tough pass to make, obviously, when you're loaded and there's ball pressure. All those things that obviously make it effective, too. So it's good. Again, I love the philosophy. Disruption, I'm assuming there aren't a lot of teams that double the post and down the ball screen. So it's a unique prep for teams as well. And I assume that's part of the point.
Right. Yeah. And then the pickup point, I think I've adjusted to the referees and the rules. I just didn't think it makes a lot of sense to pick up the floor, up the floor pressure and run the risk of getting a foul. What our defensive philosophy is, what our pickup point is, shrinking the floor. You only have to defend a certain amount of space on the floor now versus the more you extend, the more you've opened up how much room you have to defend, especially with high ball screens.
It's great stuff, Coach. Everyone I talk to about you
obviously talks about what a tremendous culture, what a tremendous, competitive attitude your players have. Can you talk about some of the keys to building culture? You've obviously done it in a lot of places. You've experienced a lot of places. But what have been some of the keys to build culture at Houston?
You know, it's easy to find kids with talent. It's easy to find kids with character. But it's really hard to find both. And we work really hard to recruit good kids. I found out that model, those kids handle adversity better. They allow you to coach them at a higher degree. And they can handle losing. I think one of the things that you have to be careful about in coaching is, do you have a team that you're comfortable losing with? Can they handle losing? And if the kids you're recruiting, is there a captain in the group? So I actively, when I evaluate kids, I try to find a captain of that class, someone that has leadership skills, someone that cares more about winning than statistics, a guy that will say thank you and please and yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. Is that necessarily? Of course not. But I do like kids that respect life and respect people. I pay attention to how they treat their mothers, what kind of relationship they have with their family. You know, all those things I think are important if you want to establish culture. Because a kid that I would say runs counter to those things, those are the kind of kids that's going to be difficult to build culture with. So to create a good culture, I think you have to have great kids, first of all. Does that mean they're all perfect? Of course not. But they all value winning. And, you know, we talk about that a lot. We talk about how do you impact winning. You know, statistics doesn't impact winning. People do. You know, just little things. Our best defender last year was Galen Robinson. The first time I saw him play, I made a comment to my assistant coach that was sitting courtside with me. I said, that kid's going to be our captain one day. Well, our captain this year on a 33-14 was that kid, Galen Robinson. And he was a great guy to build a culture around because he absolutely embraced everything about winning. So he wasn't a five-star or four-star recruit, whatever those things mean, but he was a five-star in my book. And that's one of the reasons we had the year we had.
Well, and a five-star in his mind. Absolutely. And that's another part of probably what you're talking about in terms of you get kids and obviously you develop them, but it's also the mindset that they can play with. And he played with that mindset that he thought he was that good.
Yeah. You know, toughness is a relative term, kind of like weather. It's all relative. But, you know, there's a big difference, Chris, in playing hard versus competing. We have a standard that we set every day in practice of what we define to our players what playing hard and competing is. We have multiple cutthroat drills, 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 2-on-2. And we always keep a record of your wins and losses. You know, you may have a chance to win four different drills today, a 2-on-2 drill, a 3-on-3, a 4-on-4, and then your team's going to have a 5-on-5. And we keep scoring everything. So you're either going to win or lose. So we're constantly teaching competing. You know, what's the difference in competing versus playing hard? We're always defining that throughout the course of the practice. You're not competing. You're playing hard. Okay, now you're competing. So we get them to understand the difference in that. And then we just try to carry that over. But I think every good team has to have talent, toughness, and togetherness. You better have some talent. You better be tough, and you better be together. If you have one of the three, you're going to fail. If you have two of the three, you're going to get frustrated. Now, if you have all three, you can compete for championships. And that's a big part of why our kids win.
And I've also heard you say the expression,
or I saw it in your notes, I can't remember. Sometimes playing hard is not enough. And I love that because, again, it's not just playing hard. What are some other components that go into that then, Coach?
I think it's a mindset. Sometimes I'll come in and say, okay, here's what we're going to do today. Instead of doing 2 minutes in this drill, we're going to go for 30 seconds, but I want you to go on an over a 2 minute pace in these 30 seconds. When they realize that they only have to do 30 seconds versus 2 minutes, they set a world land record in 30 seconds. And if you multiply that by, you know, 4:30s, you get 2 minutes, it would set a world's record. And so now we try to stretch that from 30 seconds to a minute to a minute and a half. Now we get the same pace, the same energy, the same effort, same intensity for 4:30 seconds, and we put them back to back to back to back, whatever the drill was. You know, I'm just constantly looking for ways to get them to understand what competition and playing hard is. And that's something that's really difficult to explain. I get asked that question a lot, Chris, but, you know, it'd be kind of like explaining what the or trying to describe what the Atlantic Ocean looks like to somebody that's never seen water.
No doubt. But I think most of our listeners can get what you're saying
because they're all coaches. Yeah. They're all coaches. And the beautiful thing that you talk about there is this competitive toughness, this culture. But more so, we throw around these words competitive. We've got to be competitive and we've got to be tough. But more so, you define it for your players because they demonstrate it every day in your drills and your practices.
Right. But that's standards. I think you have to have your individual standard. There's three people that can never have a bad practice. The head coach, your best player, and the point guard. I probably coach my point guard and my best player. And every team has a best player. And you identify it. And then you hold him accountable. There's a lot of responsibilities that go along with being the head coach, with being the point guard, with being the best player. You're not like everybody else. You're different. So your standards are going to be a little bit higher. Your individual standards has to be higher. And then the head coach has to hold them accountable. And then after that, you just create expectations every day. I have an expectation of reaching my standard that I hold for myself in terms of am I competing or am I playing hard? And how do I go from playing hard to competing? That has to be a part of your DNA as well, with everything that you're doing. You're constantly talking about that. You know, we're constantly talking about playing on the road, you know, the different type mentality it takes to play on the road, being able to have to overcome adversity. But that's why I love October, September and October, is you're just preparing your team for battle. And then when the games start, you know, it's just, you know, you're kind of reviewing and staying sharp. But the time to get better, though, is from March to October. And then once you get to November, you just got to figure out how to keep them healthy.
Absolutely. And Coach, how can I get more effort out of a guy? You talked about standard. Now, awesome. A lot of coaches have culture. They have standards. But the hard part is not that. It's keeping them connected to that, keeping them accountable to that. So what are some things, whether they're consequences or accountability or different things that you do to hold your players to that standard?
Well, a lot of it is team-based. You know, if one guy's not talking in transition, like I don't ever miss an opportunity to teach talking, whether it's on defense or offense. You know, I just value the you know, you can hear a good team. It was just getting your kids convinced of that. But my deal is just my own way of holding accountable. I don't know that anybody, you know, you have to be yourself. I tend to be animated and energetic and in practice. And I think my energy and my intensity wears off on some. It allows me to hold them to my standard, I think, more than anything else, Chris. You know, that's why head coaches have to have standards for themselves. You know, if you're not a rah-rah guy, if you're not a loud guy, you're not an overly energetic guy, then you've got to have your own way. You certainly don't have to do it a certain way. Everybody has their own way. But your ability to hold them accountable and to get them to do it. But it goes back to having good kids. You know, my best player 2 years ago was Rob Gray. I didn't coach anybody harder than Rob. The year before that, it was Damian Dotson, who plays for the New York Knicks now. I didn't coach anybody harder than I did him. Your best player allowing you to coach him hard helps you coach everybody else hard. But you can't be afraid of confrontation. I think most NBA head coaches fail because they have a hard time holding their best players accountable, especially when he won't do it himself. But the ability to embrace confrontation and how you confront that interaction between the player and the coach, I think will determine how you handle adversity throughout the season, because you're going to have it. You know, coaches are kind of like firemen. We're always putting out fires. We've got to make sure we catch them when they're little brush fires so they don't become forest fires.
Great point, and absolutely true in terms of that. And another point is, and I wanted to ask this of someone, and I thought that this is a great question for you,
because I think we always talk to coaches about what their teams do well. But what we don't consider as much is what intentionally your team doesn't do well, which is, what are you not good at as a team? And is it intentional? Because there's things that, as you said already, that you can't take away everything, or you can't do everything. So what are some things that you don't do well and you're okay with as a team?
Well, I don't know if intentional is the right word, or byproduct of. Okay. It might be a better description. You know, something that goes hand in hand with that, Chris, is offensive rebounding versus transition defense.
Great point.
There are certain teams in college basketball that send nobody to the offensive boards because they're more concerned about getting back and not allowing that team to get an early three in transition or an easy basket. They want to get their defense set up as quick as possible. So their offensive rebounding numbers are going to look bad, but it's as a byproduct of their emphasis in transition defense. You know, it's like teams that are gap team. I remember watching Virginia and Duke last year. I think the game was at Virginia, where Duke made all those threes. Well, Duke didn't get to the free throw line at all because Virginia jumped to the ball and stopped the ball in penetration. But their three-point defense percentage was not very good that night because Duke made all those threes. But they did a great job of keeping them off the free throw line. So, again, I think if you're going to take something away, you're probably going to give something up. We were in Italy this summer, Chris. We played four games over there. So I wanted, you know, it's a great time to experiment. So here's, I said, let's do this. We sent five people to the offensive boards on every shot, even the shooter. When the ball hit the floor, everybody go. Because I wanted to see how much we were going to give up in transition versus how much we gained in extra possessions and second, third chance points. And it came out to we got on the average 11 extra possessions. And I think the most easy baskets or points they scored off that was four points in one game. So we came out way ahead in that. And I wanted to see how it was. But anytime you take something away or anytime you emphasize something, you're probably going to give something up. And that's why statistics are always skewed.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And when you went five to the offensive boards, were you applying some of the tag up system where everyone finds someone and they tag them up so that that player can't run out? Or was it just five going to the offensive boards trying to get the ball?
I have this little device I use in practice. It's called a bubble. It's just a plastic rim with like little moon craters on top of it that you snap down on the rim. So when I put the bubble on the rim, that means that every shot's a rebound. And so before we went, one of the things we worked on was the angles we were crashing at. So we're a traditional NBA spacing team. So we always has the corner. We always have the corners filled, and a big is always dunk spot, a roller. You know, we got space. So we made sure at least two guys was getting to the front of the rim, because on the front of the rim, you have the ability to rebound both sides of the basket. Versus running to one side, now you have that side in the front. So you only have two areas you can rebound. And then we took, and this is an important term for the offensive rebounding team, is tips. We track how many times we go, we track how many times we tip, and then how many times that tip results in a rebound. Because we convince our kids that it takes two people to get an offensive rebound most times. Unless the ball just bounces to you, fortunately, you're never going to just get a clean offensive rebound. It's usually going to be off somebody keeping live. Now it becomes a loose ball. So we really work at that, tipping offensive rebounds, keeping them alive, and the next guy with great energy and great effort coming in and either getting it or keeping it alive for the next guy. But our rule on the flood the middle of the floor on offensive rebounds and then both sides. And then from there, we have to depend on our communication. You got a point and holler, a jersey number. We didn't know these guys' names, so we just focused on everybody's got to find a jersey number, and that's how we prepared.
That's great. And it seems, from the outside looking in,
it seems to fit your culture a little bit, too, in terms of mindset for your players, you know, just in terms of the culture of toughness and competing and all those different things. So, and I think we'll see more of it throughout, I guess, basketball at all levels as kind of, I think it evolves a little bit in people's minds. So kind of fun.
Yeah, well, little thing like moving the line back 10, 11 inches, it just means there's going to be more missed shots, which means there's got to be, for our program at least, more of an emphasis on offensive rebounds.
Well, and you guys shoot a high percentage of your shots are threes. I don't know the exact numbers, but I know that's an emphasis to shoot a lot of threes. So do you think that's going to change a little bit this year, or is it still going to be the emphasis because regardless, you're creating gravity and space?
It won't be as much of an emphasis because we don't have as good as shooters. Armani Brooks and Corey Davis, I think, made around 230 threes last year between them. That's a lot of threes. 230 from two guys. So we were a good free throw shooting team because we had two great three-point shooters. You know, if Steph Curry and Klay Thompson shot 99% of the free throws for Golden State, people say, that's a great free throw shooting team. No, Clay and Steph are. The team's just okay, but those two guys are elite. So it's a little bit of a misnomer saying we're a three-point shooting team, but I did have two elite three-point shooters last year. And then I had a couple other guys that didn't shoot near the quantity of them that are pretty good shooters. And then we have some new guys I think can grow into some of those roles, but we won't shoot as many threes for sure.
Right. No, it makes sense in terms of that. So having spent some time in the NBA,
I know we've already alluded to it a little bit. Are there some things in the NBA that you've been able to bring back to college that you feel are still underutilized in college? Is there anything that stands out to you?
I think spacing and understanding relocation, office spacing. Every coach knows what spacing is. And maybe I wasn't as smart as most of them, but I never understood how to maintain your spacing and the rules involved. And I think that's something that could help a lot of college coaches if they spend time going to some NBA practices, just listening to the NBA coaches talk about spacing and how to relocate, especially your five men. Because if your five man doesn't know how to relocate, he's going to wind up in the way a lot. So that's something that I had learned in the NBA. Greg Popovich is really good at it in San Antonio. That their spacing offense works because of their spacing, if that makes sense. And then Scott was so good about making sure that our bigs were in the right spots based on where the ball was on the floor. And then you have to convince guys to stay in the corner. You know, when you run a spacing offense, you can have weak side movement with interchange, or you can flare, pin down, whatever you want to do. But you've got to keep whatever action you do, you still got to wind up in the slot in the corner. You know, you can't come to the ball. It's not just you coming to the ball. You also bring your defender, which just kills spacing.
No, it's such an important point, is holding those corners, and not as easy, as we've talked about many times on this podcast, not as easy for players because they just want to move constantly
from those spots. But do you connect the value of the corner three to your players as well in terms of understanding the value of that spot?
Yes. We've actually, a couple of kids, my staff does a great job with player development, but our getting guys, you know, if you can shoot a 19 footer, there's no reason why you can't shoot a 21 footer. If you shoot a 20 footer, you should be able to shoot a 22 footer if you just work at it, right? Improve a little bit. And so we've done that with some guys. But their rule is that you have the green light in the corners. You know, the wings are kind of a yellow light, and then the red lights are in these areas. But that's because we've charted it. We have the analytics to back us up.
That's great. I mean, and analytics obviously have helped support your voice as a coach. And that's probably one of the biggest mindsets of that in terms of overall. So wonderful. Coach, in terms of, again, back to this culture piece a little bit and this competition a little bit, and just building a program, which you've done at so many different places, is there something you can leave coaches with at all levels of basketball in terms of these are some key things, just as you talked about? Be simple, but what are some just the overriding thing that you would focus on as a coach in those pieces?
Well, you know, there's a old saying, Chris, that your players will be reflection of the coach. I think that can be defined even more, and I put value in this. That's partly true. I think the most truest statement is they're going to be a reflection of the coach's energy in practice. I think coaches have to have great energy. He's got to be really competent in the areas he's talking about. There's certain areas that I hear coaches talk about, and I realize I'm not very good at that. So I don't do it. I do the things I'm comfortable with. I let my team tell me how we're going to practice every day. I don't pre-plan practices. I base my next day's practice off that day's practice because I know what to work on, and I know when to move on to something else. Being average, you know, people's worrying about this time of the year, I got to get my zone in, get my zone defense or my zone offense, my out-of-bounds plays, this and that. And there's probably about 30, 40, 50 things you've got to do, but choose what you want to be good at and be consistent with it. You can't do everything every day, but you can do some things every day. And those some things you do every day is what your team's going to be good at.
Love it. On that note, Coach, thank you so much for spending some time with us and sharing the game. And we look forward to watching your team this year on the court, and we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris, and congratulations to you on all your success over the years and the impact you've had on a lot of kids' lives in Canada.
Appreciate that. Thanks, Coach. To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations. So connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues
so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.